Good evening, everybody. I'm delighted to welcome you all to this timely event about time. My name is Anna Coote, and I'm not the chair of the LSE. I'm head of social policy at the New Economics Foundation, or NEF, as we call it. Now, our aim at NEF is to build a sustainable future where the economy serves the interests of people and the planet, rather than the other way around. And to this end, we bring together research, policy analysis, and hands-on, locally based practical initiatives. And uniquely, I think, among think tanks in the UK, or think and do tanks, as we say, we put the interdependence of society, economy, and environment at the heart of all our work. I want to start by thanking our partners and hosts for this event, the London School of Economics, and in particular, the Centre for the Analysis of Social Exclusion. It's been a real privilege to work with Tanya Burchard and her colleagues to arrange not only this lecture tonight, but the follow-up expert colloquium that we're holding at CASE tomorrow. So thank you very much, CASE. Last year, the New Economics Foundation published a report, which I co-authored, called 21 Hours. This sets out the preliminary case for redistributing paid and unpaid time. It suggests that we move slowly but steadily over something like a decade towards much shorter and more flexible paid working hours, with the ultimate goal of achieving a 21-hour new standard working week. And we've drawn together case studies and research findings to indicate that a move in this direction could help to address a range of urgent, interlinked social, economic, and environmental problems: overwork, unemployment, overconsumption, high carbon emissions, low well-being, entrenched inequalities, and the lack of time to live sustainably, to care for each other, and to simply enjoy life. Now, none of us imagines that this would be easy to achieve. And in the report, we identified a range of problems that would need to be addressed to make the transition. For example, low pay, employers' incentives, inequalities, the demands of global capitalism, and of course, the prevailing assumptions about what's normal and what's possible. What our aim is now is to bring together experts from different disciplines to explore the case in more depth, to build the evidence base, and to examine ways of overcoming practical and cultural barriers. We feel that it's an idea whose time has come, sorry about the pun. There's a growing interest in finding alternatives to business as usual. We were really overwhelmed by the amount of interest there's been in the run-up to this event as well. So people are interested in finding different ways of valuing and using time, money, and things, products, consumer goods. And more people are prepared to consider the case for redistributing paid and unpaid time. And it seems that social, environmental, and economic interests are beginning to converge around this subject. Sort of zeitgeist thing. So in the midst of an economic crisis, cutting the working week is seen as one way of managing a low-growth economy and helping to spread a diminishing amount of paid employment around more people, creating jobs and helping to cut the benefits bill. So that's sort of the economic interests. But it's more than just a temporary response to a crisis, because the idea also chimes with the need to cut carbon emissions and live more sustainably. How many of us really need to work long hours, to earn money, to buy stuff, and how much stuff is enough? Is going shopping the best way to build a flourishing economy and improve human well-being? If we can trade some time for some money, we can live more slowly and take better care of the natural environment. So that's the environmental case, as it were, in a nutshell. And the economic and environmental case for shorter working hours finds common ground with the social agenda, where people are calling for a better work-life balance, for more time, particularly for men, to spend with their children at home doing housework, and better gender equality, and more time for people to be active in their communities, dare I mention the big society. So the time's ripe to think about time, how we use it, how we control it, how we distribute it. And tonight we've got three leading experts to open the discussion. We have Juliet Shaw, who's Professor of Sociology at Boston College. She's the author of groundbreaking studies of the overworked and the overspent American, and her new book, Plenitude, explores the new economics of true wealth. Her analysis of work and time have been a huge inspiration to us at NEF, and we're delighted that she's been able to make the trip over to this event. And we're especially pleased that she's sharing the platform with Professor Lord Robert Skidelsky, biographer of Keynes, emeritus professor of political economy at the University of Warwick, and a former Treasury spokesman for the Conservative Party. He's a well-known visitor to this stage and widely read by this audience, I'm sure. And his forthcoming book, How Much is Enough? Economics and the Good Life, is written with his son Edward Skidelsky and will be published later this year by Penguin. Edward was due to be sharing the platform with him this evening, but unfortunately he couldn't join us. Last but not least, we're very privileged to have Tim Jackson to respond. He's a professor of environmental economics at Surrey University, author of Prosperity Without Growth. He's the leading authority on sustainable economics, and he's been a formative influence for much of the work of the New Economics Foundation. So, it's a brilliant lineup. Thank you all for being here, and thank you all for being here. Welcome to the LSE. The event is being recorded, and we hope that a podcast will be available online for anyone who can't join us tonight. And I'm sorry there are some people who couldn't get into this theatre. There are some overflow rooms now, I understand. If you're joining the discussion on Twitter, the hashtag for the event is #LSETime, all in lowercase. I'm sure most of you will know what that means. I'm not entirely certain. We'll hear from Professor Shaw first and then from Lord Skidelsky. I've asked each of them to speak for about 15 minutes and then Professor Jackson will respond. And after that, we'll open the discussion up to you. We expect to close just before 7:30 and then we're inviting you to a drinks reception afterwards, but I'll say more about that later. That's enough for me. Now please welcome Juliet Shaw.
Thank you, Anna, and it's a great pleasure to be here. Is my voice projecting all right? Yeah, great. I'm so happy that we're talking about this issue, because it's one that was very much on the agenda 20 years ago when I first started to write about work time. But in the last 10 years, I think it's really fallen off. And in the boom years of the 2000s, the question of working hours and the importance of progressive reductions in work time, I think, has really been lost. And so it's a very important that we're here today, and that there are so many of us here today, to talk about how we can get this topic back onto the political, policy, and other agenda. This is my new book, which goes into many of the issues I'm going to talk about tonight in more detail. And so if people are interested in, I'm going to have to go quickly through a lot of things because we've got 15 minutes. So it has more details. What I'm going to argue tonight is that the standard view, the conventional wisdom on working time is wrong. The conventional wisdom says that in periods of hard times, such as the one we're going through, in stagnationary periods, in recessions, etc., what we need to do is double down and work harder because we're poorer. So people have to spend more years in the labor force because our pension systems can't afford for them to retire. We need to push people's wages down, and they will therefore work harder as a result of that. We need to intensify work by laying some people off and increasing the working times of others. That's the standard view, and it's not always articulated so carefully, but it's a fallacy. And like some of the famous fallacies in economics, whether we're talking about Adam Smith's famous invisible hand fallacy, or the fallacies that Keynes identified, fallacy of composition around saving, we've got to, I think, recognize that much of the contemporary conventional wisdom on working hours is also fallacious, and that working harder and longer now is actually the wrong thing to do for a number of reasons. I'm going to argue that working hours provides us with what we call in economics a triple dividend possibility: improving the employment picture, improving ecological outcomes, and improving quality of life. And that's, it's rare to get a triple dividend policy. One of the things about working hours is that it's one of the most powerful levers for making transformational change in a system, and also one of the most, I think, underappreciated ones. So let me begin by just reminding ourselves what we're living through in terms of economic performance. I'm going to talk about the US and the UK. Obviously, a lot of differences between the two countries, but on this issue, we're actually fairly similar. We are outliers as long hours countries in comparison, particularly to Western Europe. And we were also two of the earliest hours, or the two earliest hours reducers. So we have a history that we have deviated from. So in the United States, we had a big run-up in unemployment as a result of the downturn from the financial crisis of 2007-08. And unemployment, this is our official unemployment, has stayed high. The economy is generating not even enough jobs on a monthly basis to absorb all of the new entrants to the labor force from population growth and immigration. And although things have gotten a little bit better, measured unemployment's come down a little. In part, that's also due to people dropping out of the labor market. So we're in a situation of what we, I think, can rightly now call chronic unemployment and underemployment. And in the UK also, we have a, this is a much longer time scale, we also have entered a period in which we have high and chronic unemployment and underemployment. In a period like that, work time reduction becomes extremely important because it's a key to getting back to balance in the labor market. And if you have high working hours or rising working hours in a period of high unemployment, it makes it much more difficult to generate jobs. Let me give an example. The difference in annual working hours between the United States and Germany is on the neighborhood of about 20%. So German workers work 20% fewer hours than American workers. That means that every American employer who wants to generate a new job needs, roughly speaking, 20% more revenue to get a new job. So with high hours of work, it means the bar for creating new jobs is much higher. So number one, job creation. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but I just do want to make one other point, which is that working hours reductions are also absolutely central to the debate about income and wealth inequality. We talk a lot about this. We're very aware of it. This is some figures from the United States, the big rise of the 1%, which, as you can see, gave rise to the Occupy movement, identifying the 99% and the 1% coming straight out of the trends in recent years. You also, throughout the OECD, we have increases in the levels of income inequality. One of the really important drivers of income inequality is unequal distributions of hours. And if you look over the long haul in the United States, for example, from the 1970s to the present, One of the things that's happened is that the people who have full-time jobs have seen their hours get longer, and the people who are unemployed, underemployed, casual labor, temporary, and so forth, have seen their hours shrink. So you have a majority of people, a shrinking majority, this is over the long haul, a shrinking majority of people who are overworked. And before the downturn, the average American said that they were working more hours than they wanted to, and they were even willing to give up income in order to get more free time. And a growing pool of people who are underemployed and increasingly underemployed in the sense that their desired and actual hours are getting farther and farther apart. So it's a kind of structural underemployment that happens if working hours get too high. And so redistribution of hours is a really key part of a program that leads to more egalitarian income redistributions. So the big picture that I want to leave you with here very centrally concerns the history of working hours. Now, I've got six countries here, France, Germany, Japan, Netherlands, UK, and the US. And these numbers are a little bit manufactured. You see they're all at exactly the same point in 1870. They weren't. There were a little bit of differences. The data isn't so great then. But the key point is that over the period 1870 to 1973, over that 100-year period, all of these countries had very significant reductions in working hours. They financed them through productivity increases. And all of these economies generated a lot of increase in productivity, as many of them still are, and as most capitalist economies do that. And they took a good fraction of their productivity increase in the form of shorter hours. Had they not been able to do so, they would have been unable to maintain the high levels of employment that they did for much of this period, particularly in the high productivity period before the Great Depression and then again in this later period. Why? It's just too hard to grow that fast with the amount of technological change that happens in a growing economy. There's a lot of product change, there's a lot of labor-saving change, and you can't rely on growth. Historically, no country has been able to rely on growth alone over a long period of time to keep its population employed. So what happens after 1973? Now, a number of countries keep on this path of work time reduction. So you see the Netherlands, which is pretty much the low hours country of Europe, which instituted some pretty vigorous policies to reduce hours of work and was able to maintain high employment even after 1980, when the big challenges to keeping European populations developed after that major recession in 1980. Of course, the Germans. The Americans pretty much leveled out here. With this data, and I'll show you in a minute, if you look on a household basis, this is employer data, so it's the number of hours per job. If you look per person, which allows people to add, if they have multiple jobs, add those jobs together, you see in the United States hours have actually increased. And in the United Kingdom, you've had reductions in hours, but you're still one of the, among European countries, still the high hour country. Of course, Japan, we know about long hours of work. Japan was a much, much poorer country than the rest of these countries at the time this period started. So a number of countries have stayed on this path. The US, as I said, began to deviate in earnest in 1973. On average, American workers were putting in more and more hours over this period. And it's even greater if you control for involuntary underemployment, that is, people who can't get extra hours in the labor market. If one of the things we have to realize, I think, is that we need to make sure to stay on this path of shorter working hours, or that unemployment problem which I started with, is going to worsen over time. And particularly if we listen to the policy people who say that the response to economic downturn and economic crisis is more hours of work, people in the labor force longer, and so forth, we're going to have, that's going to be a pretty bad economic outcome. We need to stay on that path in order to keep hours, in order to keep jobs. Now, somebody in the audience, or many people in the audience, are probably thinking now, lump of labor fallacy, lump of labor fallacy. Doesn't she know that there's not a fixed amount of work and that economies can always generate enough jobs? And the lump of, are people familiar with the lump of labor fallacy? It's commonly talked about in the UK, and never in the United States. I don't know if it's terminological. But the textbook models say an economy can always generate enough enough work to employ its whole population. They may need to drive their wages down because maybe people don't have productive skills and they may not be able to be employed at current wages. But this is one of the things that Keynes was so brilliant on, because Keynes taught us that if you reduce wages, you will further reduce aggregate demand. You will get more pessimistic investors, less job creation, and you may be in a worse situation overall. Fallacy of composition around saving, same thing about hours. If you put a lot more people into the labor market, if you increase hours, you will drive down wages, drive up investor pessimism, and you may end up with less employment than you started in the beginning. So in a Keynesian moment like the one we're in, the lump of labor fallacy isn't right. And secondly, we may be in a moment, I think we are, this might be something we could talk about, in which even if we could grow our way out of unemployment, we don't want to. Why is that? Well, this comes to the second point. One of the really most important things about working hours is that they are very closely connected to ecological and carbon footprints. New research that I've just completed looking at the OECD over the period 1970 to 2007 finds that countries who are on a path of work time reduction have lower carbon footprints and lower ecological footprints. Countries with higher hours of work have higher footprints. Two reasons for this. One is the impact on the overall scale of production. So if you work more, you degrade more. We know that. More economic activity. So scale of the economy. Hours of work affect the scale of the economy. If we take productivity growth in the form of shorter work time, we're not taking it in the form of more output. The second effect is the composition effect, the household composition effect, which means that people change what they do depending on their time budgets. And households who are time-stressed behave in more carbon-intensive ways. They travel faster, they eat out more, etc. So it turns out that working hours is not only connected, but is actually a very powerful and large variable for reducing ecological and carbon footprints. This is just a 2x2, but we have the whole, just to give you a picture, because you can't give a picture of these models. We have a model of all of the OECD countries over from 1970 to 2007. So here's just a quick explanation for how this works. If we have productivity growth, with fixed hours of work, it all goes into rising output and consumption, and then that creates ecological impact. The whole conversation about climate has been here on technology change. It's what you might think of as an end-of-pipe solution, because you've already had that increased output, increased scale, which gives you a big increase in carbon emissions, eco-footprint. By contrast, if you reduce hours of work, you get less growth in output. You could take all your productivity growth to reduce hours of work with no growth in output. Technology comes in to give you another source of reduction, and you can get a lot more. It's much easier to meet your carbon targets in a world where you are experiencing progressive reductions in working hours caused by, or financed through productivity growth. So to sum up, the triple dividend of shorter hours. Shorter hours lead to lower unemployment and more job creation. Shorter hours reduce eco and carbon footprints. And this is the third benefit I haven't talked about, extremely important, I think one we're probably more familiar with. Shorter hours give people more free time, reduce stress, enhance family life and community. And there's now a growing economics around this, around the impact of social capital on a variety of economic outcomes. So it's not just a social desirable, but it's also an economic desirable. I want to end by saying something about how you get there, because I think it's a lot easier for people to agree about the idea that shorter working hours could be a good thing, but there's a lot of complexity and also a lot of disagreement about whether it's feasible and how to do it. And I'm going to focus for the first point is on, not on businesses, but on people, on workers, the people who work these schedules. What I argue is that it's very important to move on a trajectory of progressive work time reduction in which you use productivity growth to finance those increases, because you don't need to take income away from people by doing it this way. People have what we call in behavioral economics asymmetric preferences. They feel very differently about income that they have than income that they don't yet have, future income. They're very resistant to giving up current income. They are not at all resistant to foregoing income they don't yet have, particularly if the alternative is to get free time. And there's lots of data on that. So losing income is painful. Do not think about work time reduction strategies in a way that entails taking income away from people, particularly in recessionary periods. The second really important thing about it is that that the labor market gives people relatively little choice in hours. Employers, for the most part, set hours. And we can call this a missing market. So if you want to argue about this to people who believe in free choice and markets and all of that, one of the key things to do is to say we need a market in hours. Give people choice. Don't force career penalties on them for taking shorter hours. And this is something that countries like the Netherlands and Denmark have done. They have made it illegal for employers to discriminate against people who ask for shorter schedules. There's a big reservoir of demand out there, particularly among high-educated people, for more time. The Dutch went about this in a really smart way. They started with the government, and all new government employees in the early 1980s went into jobs that were 80%. They worked 4 days, they got 80% of the salary. They started coming out of school they weren't going from 100% salaries down to 80 for the most part. So these were new hires who were happy to get jobs. You can hire 5 people at 80% rather than 4 people at 100%. Eventually the whole Dutch financial system went on to this, and work time reduction, the short hours spread throughout. So build a lot of flexibility in. In the Netherlands, you can be a 4-day-a-week professor, you can be a 1-day-a-week professor. So they have those markets that allow a tremendous amount of flexibility. And finally, this is my last point, give people full days off. They're much more valuable to people than shorter, smaller increments of time. And when you give people a 3-day work week, they become very accommodated to it. They have those asymmetric preferences about time, and it comes to be a very popular policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll move straight on.
I think it's too hazardous to be this space. I'm at the moment a no-day-a-week professor, having retired. In economics, work has always been regarded as painful. It's the cost you pay in order to get the goods you want. And that's why, in standard economic analysis, people prefer leisure to work. They only work up to the point when the marginal utility of one extra hour of income is greater than the marginal disutility of one extra hour of leisure. I mean, that's the way they set this up. Now, from this, you can draw the conclusion that if our productivity grows, we should reduce the number of hours we work, as it requires less effort to obtain the same basket of goods. If you have a choice to increase your intake of goods or take more leisure, you know, we seem to have that choice, standard economic analysis suggests that you will take more leisure the richer you get. Now, this is indeed what Keynes thought. He wrote an essay, Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, in 1913, which he predicted that by this time, you know, by the time this very lecture is taking place this evening, people would be four or five times richer, on average, than they were in 1930, and would work, on average, only about 15 hours a week. Well, we've just had some data on the work hours, and we know it's not anything like that. In fact, people work about, on average, about 40 hours a week, and there's no hope whatsoever of getting to a 15-hour week in any measurable period of time. In fact, what's happened in a curious way is that an inverse relationship has developed between income and work. The richer you are, the harder you work. Among an important group in society, there are very few rich who are idle, and of course very few idle who are rich. So I mean, this again goes against what economists tended to believe. The question then, obviously, is why hasn't the income-leisure trade-off that Keynes sort of thought might happen, or would happen, not happened? Well, there's several possible explanations. I'll just go through them very briefly. The first I label the joys of work. People point out that work has become much more agreeable than it used to be, not so much a pain as a pleasure. It obviously involves much less physical toil, there's much more variety of job, workplaces are more agreeable. Work is fun. And that is why people don't give it up as readily as earlier generations of economists thought they would when most work wasn't fun. It was very, very hard. So that's one type of explanation. Work is fun, and obviously Google and its buildings operate on this principle, a fun environment for the workforce. Now, a second explanation is fear of leisure. Me, I dread the weekends, remarks the workaholic lady journalist in Tom Rackman's The Imperfectionist. I wish I didn't have vacation time. I have no idea what to do with it. It's like a four-weekend reminder of what a loser I am. Well, fear of leisure is psychologically, it is of some importance, but I don't think it's the main explanation for why people go on working. There is a sort of compulsory sociability about work, which some people treasure and wonder what to do if it's removed. The third explanation lies beneath the averages. You know, we talk about average this, average that. It's true that average per capita income has risen in line with Keynes's expectations, but inequality of income, we've heard this, has grown enormously in the last 30 years, with the richest gaining most from the growth of the economy, especially in the United States and the UK. And this suggests to me that a large number of workers are not, in fact, receiving salaries which are consistent with the marginal product of their labour. In fact, the structure of the labour market is such that workers are not, in many cases, in a position to determine their own real wage. They're off their supply curve, and that is straightforward Marxist theory of exploitation. And they're not being paid what they're worth. Well, if and that means that they're not as rich as they thought they did. In fact, the average tells you they might be. In fact, median incomes have been repressed and rather flat So the fourth explanation is the one with which Juliet's name is imperishably associated, and that is the labour market. She argues in a number of books that competitive pressures force employers to work their existing workforces harder than spreading the work around. And she also makes a very, very important point, which I'm not sure she touched on in her talk, is that the inability of workers to realise their desire for less work and more leisure is compensated by the delusive promise of more consumption. I mean, maybe you didn't say that, but I mean, in other words, the power of capital in the labour market has its exact counterpart in the growth of the pressures of consumerism. Those two things always have to be taken together. Now, the final explanation, I think, has less to do with structures of power than with the rather reprehensible feature of human nature that we tend to be insatiable. And now I know that insatiability can be inflamed, but in any society, there seems to be some relational aspect of consumption, which is what causes people to want more and more. And economists have identified three forms of this. First, they're bandwagon goods that are desired because others already have them. All my friends have iPads. I must get one too, said I the other day, and have indeed made the purchase. Then they're snob goods, goods that are desired because others don't have them. And such goods cater to the desire to be different, exclusive, to stand apart from the crowd. They're not necessarily the most expensive, but mark their possessors as being people of exceptionally good taste. Snob and bandwagon goods are not, of course, mutually exclusive. Many snob goods mutate into bandwagon goods, leading to their abandonment by true snobs. All these are to do with the quirks of human nature. Overlapping with both snob and bandwagon goods are Veblen goods, so-called in honor of the great American theorists of conspicuous consumption. Well, Veblen's goods are desired because they're expensive and are known to be expensive. In fact, they function as advertisements of wealth, like underground swimming pools, which some districts in Chelsea, some houses in Chelsea, cannot be without underground private swimming pools. In fact, there was someone I know who's just become elected a councillor in certain wards in Kensington Chelsea. He goes up to the doorsteps and asks his potential voters, and what's your main problem? The noise that our neighbours are making in installing their underground swimming pools is simply beyond tolerance. Will you do something about it? Of course, the fact is that the houses are all likely to fall down because all their foundations are being eroded. But this is an example of conspicuous consumption, obviously. So insatiability is a fact. And I think if you're trying to analyse these different reasons for the hours of work not falling, I would say the most important have to do with the structure of power in the economy, and this fact of human nature, that relational competition goes on, a relational competition in consumption. So what do we do about it? How do we escape from the rat race? Well, the problem has two aspects, intellectual and political. The intellectual problem is to work out what one might mean by a good life, a life desirable in and of itself, regardless of whether it's actually desired. I think one has to make that distinction to start with, just to get some clear thinking on it. For it's only in relation to such an idea that the notion of having enough can be given a fixed meaning. Without it, we've got nothing but the shifting fortunes of the Joneses direct our wants. Now, and then the political problem which arises from that is how to structure our social and political institutions so they can make it easier for people to actually lead a good life. Now, it's not such a difficult a problem as we might imagine to get some agreement on what a good life is. The intellectual and religious leaders of the pre-modern world all had ideas of what the good life was. These ideas varied. Some laid stress on political participation, others on family happiness, some emphasized communion with nature, others civic debate. They're quite a wide range, but all shared the common idea that there was something such as the good life, and that money was only a means towards it, that money was never an end. And from this perspective, to want more than enough is plainly a vice, the vice of avarice, as I think moral philosophers tended to take it. And to accumulate without end, like Mrs. Marcos and her shoes, is plainly pathological. But a lot of our consumption is pathological. After all, money is for something, so to pursue it for its own sake, to pursue it in order to get more of it and more of it, so one can get more and more of everything else. Well, it's rather like saying that the purpose of eating is just to get fatter and fatter. I mean, I know that is quite common, but one would regard it as a pathological condition. One of the great economists to share this perspective was Keynes himself, who wrote, "There'll come a time when the love of money as a possession, as distinguished from the love of money as a means to the enjoyments and realities of life, will be recognized for what it is, a somewhat disgusting morbidity." One of those semi-criminal, semi-pathological propensities which one hands over with a shudder to specialists in mental disease. And he thought that by this time, 100 years hence, this is how wealth, the mindless pursuit of wealth, would be regarded. Far from it, he was wrong. It's regarded as one of the great signs of our progressive, dynamic, competitive civilization. So one has to try and recapture the idea that there is something called a good life to which wealth is a means, and orient our social institutions towards it. Our book, the book I'm writing with my son on this, identifies 7 basic goods. You may disagree with them, but I think they're the start of the discussion. Goods that an individual must possess in order to be said to lead a good life. Their health, security, respect or dignity, personality, friendship, harmony with nature, and leisure. And notice that happiness doesn't appear on this list, something which I have considerable disagreements about with Richard Layard. This is because we think that happiness, in the standard modern sense of a pleasant state of mind, is not necessarily a good at all. It all depends what one is happy about. To sweep a slushy crossing for 8 hours on a day when the east wind is blowing is a disgusting occupation, wrote Oscar Wilde. To sweep it with joy would be appalling. You know. So the idea of making everyone joyful as a sort of aim of social policy must be rubbish. Let me just go quickly to the political requirements for moving towards a realization of elements of a good life. Our first aim should be to alter the labour market so that workers have greater choice over how much labour to supply. I mean, that is your market in hours. I wish I could disagree more with what you've been saying, but I seem to be adding footnotes to it. But to create a labour in hours is terribly important. And secondly, and this is a point perhaps which is more distinctive, to remove the pressures to consume which distort people's decision to supply leisure. So in technical terms, we should A, try to get workers back onto their labour supply curves, and B, permanently to shift those supply curves downwards. There are different sets of policies that one can imagine doing these things. The simplest would be to, for the first, work sharing, would be to legislate for a progressive reduction in the hours of work by limiting weekly hours and or increasing statutory vacation times. I think both of those things have a part to play. And you know, there's nothing new in this. The Factory Act started this process in the 19th century. We now have a European Work Directive which sets a maximum 48-hour week. Naturally, our governments opted out of it. And that explains why the British work a lot more than the Europeans, most of them. And they work almost as much as the Americans. The Americans and the British work about 200 or 300 hours a year more than most continental Europeans without, as far as one can see, any considerable gain in GDP per capita, even though GDP per capita is a very, very imperfect measure of a standard of living, as you'll know if you think about it. So you can do that within such a framework of a maximum working week. Then employers and workers can work out their own bargains in the flexible way that has already been described. So I won't dwell on it. And then you'll have to provide incentives of one kind or another. This is all an incentive-based program of nudging. I don't want to be totalitarian about this. I don't want to say to anyone, you are not allowed under any circumstances to work more than 15 hours a week. I mean, you can't do it that way, and no one's proposing that it should be done that way. So that's the first point. A second element in our idea would be to have a basic income. The rich have always lived off unearned wealth. Why shouldn't more people? And the richer society gets, the more you can spread that. So that should be financed logically by a tax on wealth. So that would be a second thing we would advocate. Now we turn to the other side of the story, which is pressure to reduce pressures on consumption, to consume more. How do we deal with that? Well, the tax system should be used, I think, point one, to offset employers' power over real wages. And therefore, I think we should have a progressive tax system. I would favour a progressive consumption tax, because that, it seems to me, deals with the distributional question and the consumption question at the same time. I would have a progressive consumption tax. It's a very old idea. Many people have advocated it administratively. It shouldn't be too difficult, no more difficult really than income tax. There are pros and cons. This is a debatable issue, but a consumption tax, which falls very heavily on luxury items of consumption, would sort of reduce the pressure to escalate competitive consumption upwards, which the luxury spending of the rich now actually does. And finally, I would limit advertising. Again, people often say this is an absolutely unacceptable interference with liberty, but in fact the state already forbids many forms of advertising, particularly of the so-called sin goods, like tobacco. Well, a lot of goods are sin goods that are advertised that aren't, you know, that ought to, you know, they ought to come at least with health warnings. And many democratic states already limit advertising. It's a big problem because advertising has migrated to the internet, and if it's restricted in one area, it'll spread everywhere. Our society is organized on that principle, and unless there is, first of all, an intellectual acceptance or a spiritual acceptance of the notion that there is a good life and it is not the life that we are being offered, unless that is accepted, then none of these reforms will take place, or they'll take place in such an emasculated form that they won't do any good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and to comment on, respond to such erudite speakers. And to be honest, I've very little idea what to say, but it's fine because they took up so much of the time that I either have to say a lot of things very fast, or perhaps nothing at all. And there is a lesson that I'd like to draw through the theme of my responses. And the first response, to say a lot of things very fast, is really a thematic response of our economies. It's all about productivity. In fact, both the speakers, and this is a point where I might disagree with both of the speakers assumed implicitly, actually, that economic progress continually increases the productivity of economies. And that would seem to be a good thing, because it means you can get more out of each person for each hour worked. It means that you can spend less of your time, if you choose to do so, in working time and more in leisure, as indeed we have done in some economies. And actually, this continual pressure of productivity is an incredibly important structural feature of the modern economy. In fact, it's often seen as what drives growth in the economy. It gives us lower working hours, but as long as you're more productive in those fewer working hours, you can increase your output and you can keep that going. And so there is a built-in rhetoric in the economic system to continually increase productivity, and there are hundreds of studies about how to do this. Hundreds of studies of comparing what we're doing in Europe against what we're doing in the USA. Hundreds of studies looking at the productivity in different sectors and valuing those sectors which have high productivity growth rates as being the way to get the growth in the economy. And in the UK, we did that very explicitly over the last decade or so, and we decided that the place to get productivity growth was not in manufacturing, it wasn't in the service sectors, except in that little corner which we called financial services, a little bit of retail, and some new technologies, which were moving very fast at the time. And if you look at the statistics for the UK over that period, that's where all the productivity growth came from. But where, in fact, did that leave us? Chasing productivity in those sectors. It left us with an economy incredibly fragile because it has no real manufacturing base. Incredibly fragile because the professions which rely on service activities were denigrated as being low productivity sectors, and money was continually pumped into the capitalization of those sectors to try and squeeze productivity out of them. What was the result of that? The result of that was a survey yesterday published of nurses in the UK, in which it was found that the degree of empathy in nurses was disappearing. Why was it disappearing? Because they were asked to work harder hours, to perform newer tasks, to have all this accounting about their output during those tasks. During that time, the quality of their working time was systematically degraded by the chasing of productivity within sectors which are about service, which are about human interaction, which are about the time that one person gives to another in improving their lives, in doing all the things that Lord Skidelsky was talking about in terms of personal flourishing and social flourishing. And it might be surprising to know that this tendency of economists to squeeze out working time, to get more from each working time, has been seen, in fact, as a kind of disease in the modern economy, particularly associated with service sector activities. It was attributable to the economist William Baumol. And his wonderful example, which I like very much and is a little bit similar to the example I started my talk with, is that you wouldn't necessarily ask an orchestra to play a symphony twice as fast. It just doesn't really do justice to the notes that were written on the page. It doesn't create a better quality of experience. It's not more fun to play it if you're in the orchestra, and it certainly isn't more fun to listen to it. And that's true, of course, of a number of activities. It's true of all the activities in which it's human time that contributes the experience of production, the experience of giving one's time in labour, and it contributes to the experience of receiving time in labour. And yet this sector, this service sector, where productivity growth is rather low, where productivity itself is rather low, is an incredibly important sector. If you were to ask the question, where does our next economy come from? Where is the economy in which we can have low carbon activities, which are resource light, which have little in demands in terms of material resources and little in emissions of carbon from them? Where are the activities which contribute to our quality of life, which improve our health, improve our education, improve our social care, improve the quality of our leisure time? Many of these activities are service activities in which people are giving labour, giving time, providing inputs as human beings, as producers, to human beings as consumers. Human beings actually working together to contribute not just to economic growth, not just to economic output, but actually to the quality of each other's lives. Here is a vision actually of a new economy, which makes a lot of sense under all sorts of conditions, under conditions of demand, when the demand for goods stagnates, there are still things to be done in terms of building services. When carbon emissions have to be capped, there are still a lot of activities which could be carried out in very low carbon ways. When the quality of people's lives is deteriorating, actually there are still jobs to be done which are high quality jobs, which contribute quality of life both to the worker and to the person who's receiving those services. It's a fantastic sector of economic activity, and it counts for almost nothing in modern economics, in traditional economics, in the conventional view of the economy, in conventional politics. This sector is denigrated. So my point, and it's not really in contradistinction to the idea that we should be working less or should we be taking our productivity gains in terms of fewer working hours, it is actually to say there's a counterbalancing force, which is to resist the constant urge towards productivity growth, particularly in those sectors where it's human services that are traded between people. And this is a sector, it seems to me, that can meet all of Juliet's requirements to increase employment, because it is less productive in conventional terms. It's more employment rich. It has more jobs in it. It can reduce the carbon intensity of our economies, and it can increase the quality of our working experience. And I want to really just finish on the question of quality of working experience. I think both the speakers made it quite plain, really, that the time itself is a strange commodity. It isn't just about having and doing. It isn't just about work being bad and pleasure being good. It isn't necessarily just about the nightmare of the vacation when you've built all your social standing and your credibility around who you are as a working person. Either of those places, work and leisure, can be heaven and they can also be hell. And in fact, the pressure to create a continually growing economy in which productivity is squeezed, in our working lives become more busy, and our leisure lives become full of more shopping-intensive activities so that we consume more to create standing, this is the pathology. It is this pathology of squeezing time through the frame of productivity growth to increase output in the economy that is at the root, I believe, of these issues. When I was when I first started my working life, and I can excuse myself on those grounds, really, I was probably young and naive. Sometimes I was working for an organization called the Stockholm Environment Institute, and sometimes I used to just not go to work. I could do that. I had the luxury of doing that because the Stockholm Environment Institute, please don't tell them this if you come across anyone. They funded an office space for me in London, and most of the team was in Stockholm. And so it was really up to me whether I went to work. Now, I'm a highly motivated person. I tend to work too hard, as many people in the audience probably do as well, because, in fact, we enjoy it. But every now and then, I will ask myself, what is the purpose of my working day? And broadly speaking, because I was working in more or less the same area then as I am now, it was to reduce carbon emissions across the world. It was to reduce environmental impact across the world. And so I would ask myself when I got up in the morning, sometimes, particularly if it was sunny, what is the opportunity cost of me working this day? And what is the benefit of me working this day? How much carbon will I save by getting on the train, going to North London, sitting in my office all day, writing a report which may or may not be read by somebody, and having the impact of that report transfer itself to carbon emission reduction? Actually, the calculus is pretty simple. I went to the common and lay in the sun and read a book. And that's, I think, not a stupid analogy. It's not a naive question to ask ourselves, what is the value of our time? And what is the quality of our experience in that time? And I think when you begin to ask those questions, you discover that time itself has some rather malleable qualities. It isn't always a simple division between work and leisure. It isn't always a simple division between good and bad. It isn't even a simple division between pleasure and unpleasure. Actually, it's a very, very slippery commodity. And more things can happen in a very short space of time doing absolutely nothing than can happen in very, very full working hours, 12-hour days in conventional jobs. And those questions, I think, when you begin to ask them, free yourself up to think about time in different ways. And there is, I would argue, just one really big remaining task, which is how to make an economy work when it isn't chasing productivity, when it isn't chasing continual growth. And fortunately for those of us who are working it, that's a task which is almost insatiable in its appetite for working time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim, and thanks to all the speakers. We now have about 20 precious minutes left of this occasion, and I'm going to go straight out and ask for questions. See how many people want to talk. Okay. I'll try and take them in two batches, but we will probably only have time for two rounds of questions. And please keep them brief, and please say who you are before you make your intervention. Okay, this woman here. I'll go up this side first, and you there, and the gentleman behind you. And then I'll go to you there, yes. That's you there, and the man at the very top, and then I'll come back to you.
Hello, can you hear me? Hi, my name is Isabella Cota. I'm a Mexican journalist, and my question actually is in regards to Mexico. Mexicans work the most out of all OECD countries. We work 10 hours a day, 4 of them are unpaid. And the problem of Mexico is not really unemployment, but the concentration of wealth. We have the highest rate of inequality in Latin America, the second highest among OECD countries. Now, I understand that the redistribution of working hours would help Mexico, but what I'm wondering is how much would it really help, and who would need to take the initiative in a country like Mexico? Would it have to be the businesses, or would it have to come from the government as a mandatory kind of thing? Thank you.
Good. Well, store that question. Next man up there, in the middle there. Do we have any more roving mics? Yep. Okay, maybe you could do that, do the next one. Okay. Yep, go on.
Hi, I'm Guppy Bowler. During the day I work for Oxfam, but at night I guess I'm a public health activist, if that makes sense. There was mention of a tax on luxury products, a consumption tax, but what about stemming it from the cause of consumption, which was advertising, which you also pointed out, and whether if taxing advertising will have an impact on the number of hours we work. There was a report that was released in October by PERC, the Public Interest Research Centre, and WWF, and it was about advertising, and it showed the impact that advertising was having on society's values. So I think, if you read that, it showed that it increases working hours because of the need for consumption, or society's need for consumption, but also that taxing advertising might have an impact.
Thank you. Okay. Next one.
Hello, my name is Alex Holland. I work for an environmental justice NGO. And when this report came out, I was tremendously excited. I thought, this is brilliant. This is what I've been waiting for. And I was telling everyone I knew about it. And at that time, at my work then, I was a GMB shop steward, so workplace organizer. And I was talking to my union members, and I go, this is fantastic. You know, you work less. Maybe you won't have as many iPads, but you get to spend so much more time with your family, your wife. And then one of my members raised his hands, and he goes, I come to work to get away from my wife. this is never going to work. But beyond that, his personal circumstances, there were concerns raised in terms of, and they were raised in the report as well, about things like pensions. How is this going to affect my pension if my hours go down? If I'm working on a relatively low income, how am I going to survive? Not necessarily from people who are super consumption focused, but put most of their money into their houses and other assets because they feel that's the only way they're going to survive in the future.
Okay, that's enough. Thank you. Next one up there, you, and then there's a man at the right at the top, and then we're going to come round here.
My name's Harold Emanuel. I'm a solicitor. It seemed to me that a lot of what was said by the panel, that, there seemed to be some kind of underlying assumption that there was a causal relationship between the number of increased working hours and productivity. That would suggest that the Germans who work 20% less than the Americans are firstly stupid and secondly lazy, neither of which I should imagine is the case. I believe, in fact, in Germany, if you don't end, if you carry on working rather beyond the end of the official working day, you're regarded as somebody who is incapable of completing the work in the required time. And I remember when I worked for a couple of years in a commercial law firm in this country, I discovered very quickly that you never had a meeting during the day if you could possibly have it in the middle of the night. And I wonder, therefore, what the panel has to say about the apparent cause, about whether there is such a causal relationship.
Thank you. Right at the back there, and then I'm going to come round to the middle block. You all have to be really quick, and I'm going to have another round of questions before I come back to the speakers, because otherwise we won't get through it. So, very quickly, please.
My name's Peter Logan. Hello. I don't have a question, so save you having to answer it. But I would like to say that I came here after having listened to Start the Week on Monday morning and listening to the idea of the 21-hour working week, which Andrew Marr said was a radical idea. To my mind, it's merely a step in the right direction. And the way forward is not an intellectual and economic debate, but a debate about ideas. What is lacking, which I've heard from so many people in the past few months and year or two, is that there is no vision about where we're going. That's what's missing.
Thank you. Okay, now let's see who wants to talk in the middle. Right. We'll do you there, yes, with that you, yes. Sorry. No, not you, the one behind. Right. And then we'll come down to you. Now, and then the lady at the front here. Okay, quickly.
Sorry, hello, I'm James Warman. I'm the editor at a consultancy called The Future Laboratory. My question, I got two really, is one way to encourage the shorter working week to the 21-hour week, to encourage the consumption of experiences rather than stuff, so encourage people in that direction. And do you think that as a society we've had enough of stuff, or we're moving in that direction?
Good. And the gentleman there.
Michael Bailey, Sheffield. We know there are lots of old people in hospital who aren't even fed properly. We know there are lots of old people at home who need a great deal more care. Therefore, it seems logical that people should be provided to do the job. But we're told sometimes we can't afford it. Why not?
One more here, and then...
Özlem Onaran, University of Westminster. I want to come back to the issue of redistribution that was both in your report, of the NEF report, as well as in Juliet's presentation. But we haven't talked too much about, I think, functional income distribution, the distribution between profits and wages, which has been also changing dramatically in the last two decades. And one way of reducing working hours and making it popular for people would be to say, we do it with wage compensation, which means hourly wages increase, wage per person stays the same, but since people will be working fewer hours for the same wage, that would be a redistribution from profits to wages. Obviously, that is a huge political issue, an issue of power, but I think it is something we have to discuss very carefully, and obviously the written wage distribution is also important. What will happen to median wages? How can we preserve them? And then there is the top wages, and there comes the issue of also not just minimum wage, but maximum wages. So I would just want to hear your feedback on that. Particularly, it's not so much about, I think, productivity being reflected to ours, but a redistribution between profits and wages. They will come with its fallbacks, but I know we don't have time for that.
Thank you. Now, I'm just going to have a little discussion with my speakers here. Can you bear to wait for another, even more questions, or would you like, do you think we'd better go back to you now? Go on.
hard to remember them all, but yeah. I mean, remember don't the you ones think that people want to hear the answers? Or what's our...
Well, you see, I've been really unfair now because I've got to do
whatever.
This side.
Yeah, yeah, go
I
for it.
I have to distribute equally the questions around the room. Carry on. Somebody. Okay, all right, now then. There's a gentleman there, and then we'll take that. Man there. I can't.
Hi, my name's Patrick Worthington. I'm a social work manager. I've certainly had some fun in my work life, although I forget, it wasn't too long ago. Question, lots of very decent people work far too hard, and they're doing more so now, and I do believe it's unproductive. Is there a place for the government to actually say, for new starters, 3 days, 4 days?
Okay, the gentleman there is...
Right. Good evening. My name is William Wong. I work in arts and mental health. On Sunday, David Cameron was saying to Andrew Marr on BBC television, he said every government department's priority now is on growth and growth. I just wonder what the panel would advise the government to think and do differently.
Thank you. Now, there's a lady there in a red cardigan. And there's a gentleman right at the top next in there with a sort of white shirt on. Okay.
Caroline Nichols, I'm an LSE graduate and I did my degree on 21 hours a week, so it can be done. My question is, on the other side of it, I'm very concerned, I'm a local councillor, that councils are under instructions to put a price on everything. We are getting rid of those places where people can come together and be social. Everything we do together, we now have to pay for. And I think that's the other side of the equation. And I wondered whether you thought there was anything we could do to change that culture. Thank you.
Right at the top there.
William Bradley, I currently work at the GLA. Two quick questions. Firstly, what are you doing at NEF to reduce your employees' working hours, if at all? Are you experimenting with this? And secondly, Professor Skidelsky, if you're writing a book about reducing consumption and buying an iPad, what chance does society have?
If you're writing a book and buying an iPad, what chance does society have? Okay, now I just wanted to pick up some here. Yes, this very obvious person wanted to speak up the back there. And then wait a minute, just so we can know where we're going. Two rows down from there. And
okay. To what extent could companies benefit from these sorts of ideas in the current context, and what are the key facts that you would refer to sort of managers to make the case for that?
Chris Snowden, number one. Yes.
Yeah, go on.
20 hours on the minimum wage is less than £7,000 a year. And even on an average wage at 20 hours, it would be about £12,000. So what we're talking about here is most people being in what is now regarded as poverty. I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, but having half as many hours and you've got half as much money, half the GDP. But no one's really come out and said that explicitly. Is that what you mean? And are you happy with that? If so...
All right. Now, I think actually we'd better stop there. Because otherwise it's really not fair. And if you feel that your question hasn't been answered, there is the drinks reception afterwards, so you can try and get an answer then. I'm sorry we haven't been able to. I was trying... It had better be really good. And quick.
Yes. I just think it would be such a shame to lose the benefit of having all these people here at this fantastic event. So my question is, can we start some kind of organisation or campaign to take this forward? I'm not an academic. I used to be on New Ways to Work. Okay. I'm a campaigner.
Thank you.
It would be great.
We were
told
by our partners at the LSE that we were examining the case for a shorter working week. We were not launching a campaign. Perhaps that's something for NEF to take into account. But thank you for the very important proposal, suggestion. Juliet, answer the questions you think were important or that you remember.
I've got all my notes. I'm going to go really fast.
I think that there's a lot more to understanding what drives consumption than advertising. Inequality is really at the core of that, and it's also at the core of this whole issue. So the things we do to reduce inequality will also reduce hours of work. That also speaks to your question. Countries with more equality have shorter hours, more inequality have longer hours. So that's another really key variable here. But that point about what drives competitive consumption, inequality, and particularly increases in inequality, are really central to that. What's the causal relation between hours and productivity? We've been talking mostly about using productivity that's happened in, you know, that's actualized in the economy to reduce hours. Shorter hours are typically associated with higher per hour productivity. And that's the main answer to your question, I think. Did we consume too much stuff? The second chapter of my book actually has some pretty horrifying numbers on the material dimensions of the consumer binge of the 2000s. And I think that there is a kind of hangover effect that's going on now, certainly in my own country, I suspect a little bit here too, among some people, because it was a period of very rapid acceleration of consumption and also acceleration of discard of goods. So it was a churning, which meant clearly that the kind of value that people were getting out of these goods wasn't necessarily what we might think of, because they were getting rid of them almost as fast as they were buying them. The problem with reducing hours through general increases in wages is that you have, a little bit down the road, negative employment effects, because higher wages lead to lower employment. Other things being equal, there's a whole literature on this. If you have an activist enough government to try and deal with that, yes. But one of the beauties about doing it through productivity increases is that it's not cost raising for business. They can maintain competitive position. They can maintain their economic viability if you fund it through productivity increases. That having been said, despite the bad rap it got, the French movement to the 35 also increased wages for people at the bottom. And that's really, if you have a government policy to move in this direction, you can do that. You increase those wages. The last point is the man who asked about, are people at the bottom getting half? No. I mean, in the way I'm talking about it, the current incomes aren't falling. It's just that they're not going up with future productivity increases. I'm done.
Okay. Well, I'll skip the things that you've answered, the common questions. Redistribution is the answer to a lot of this, and I think when our economies were working reasonably well. At least I'm talking of the UK economy in the 1950s, 1960s, incomes were much more equal. Of course, Galbraith at that time used to talk about countervailing power. And then you had the system, capitalist system, then you had very strong trade unions, which were able to push up wages in line with productivity increases. And then you had the government, a more activist Keynesian social democratic government. And that all then broke down for various reasons, historically and so on. And now we have no countervailing powers. And therefore, the government has to do a lot more, because really a system was set up in which trade unions were marginalized. I mean, that was actually, I think, the inner logic of the switch to a service economy. Where you assume that unions are going to be hostile to the efficient working of an economy, you then try to create an economy in which unions are superfluous. The Germans didn't do that. They went another route. They thought that they had a cooperative relation with their unions, and they preserved a lot more of their manufacturing industry. And so did the Dutch. and Danes. There was a question here about Germany. This was your experience of Germany, but in fact, the Germans have been very, very important pioneers in shorter working week experiments, and there's a very famous case in Volkswagen, where they did reduce their working week, I know, from 35 hours to 28, employed, kept a lot more people in work, and actually achieved quite considerable productivity gains. I'm not quite sure that I agree entirely with Juliet on the question of pushing productivity. I mean, I think you can make a very tenable case that a lot of workers are not actually receiving wages which are consistent with their existing marginal product. And increasing productivity as such is not necessarily going to help there. It depends on how productivity gains are distributed. I would have thought the answer to the problem of workers in low pay, first of all, raise minimum wages. Secondly, you have all sorts of in-work credits. I mean, those are things that happen at the moment. Thirdly, there's much more redistribution in the economy. So you are actually taking away money from capital and giving it to labour in one form or another, in kind. Why are there not enough people available to be carers for old people? Well, because, I mean, our public services have been starved. We can't afford them. You see, we can afford very large bonuses for our bankers, but we can't afford to maintain our public services. I mean, that is a crazy accountant's logic, which makes no sense even in any economics I'm aware of. So I think those things have to be addressed. One last point here: growth. The issue of growth, of course, to my way of thinking, you don't aim. Growth of GDP should not be an aim of economic policy. Whether GDP grows or stagnates or falls is immaterial. It's the resultant of trying to achieve a good life, as we have defined it. Now, GDP is a very, very, very poor measure of anything that anyone means by a good life. It's not entirely irrelevant, of course it's not, but it's a very imperfect measure. You add to GDP by pursuing activities which pollute the environment, pollute the planet. You subtract from GDP by doing what you did. You decided to read a book in the sun. That is a subtraction from GDP. You're not producing anything in that time. Nothing that enters into market exchange.
I did buy the book.
Oh, so you added to employment somewhere, but I wonder whether you wouldn't have produced more had you actually decided to work more GDP. Now, there's a distinction here between short term and long term. Sorry, I'm going to finish in a second. If you're in a slump, then everyone wants to maximise employment. It's natural, and I think it's right. And therefore people are interested in increasing the output of the economy, and that is growing it. But I think of that in terms of recovering output. We've lost 10% of output if you include the years in which actually output hasn't been growing to trend. And that's a huge loss, and it's everyone is poorer. So I think you need to distinguish between the short run, when you really want to be to increase output, and a vision of 20 years. I was asked about the vision. Our vision is the good life.
Yeah, can't possibly answer all the questions, but I think that some key themes arise out of this. One of them is the question of distribution, and that clearly is a theme. It's been raised implicitly and explicitly by a number of people. If your productivity is growing and you're reducing your working hours, you can only really give people a better quality of life if you're redistributing incomes. I mean, that seems pretty clear. And the questions around redistributing income are also questions about redistributing access to material goods and services. And access to material goods and services is a part of what the good life consists in. So it is... not misleading, but potentially dangerous to suggest that it's possible to have a good life simply by not having money. That's only true in a society in which incomes are more equally distributed. It's only true in a society in which the conditions for the good life are available to not just the rich, but to everyone. So that question of access is incredibly important. When you look at the studies on poverty that date back to the 1970s, what you find is that poverty has never just been about material things. It's always been about access. It's always been about the conditions in which you can participate in the life of your society. Mary Douglas' wonderful quote, consumption itself, the objective of the consumer is to build a credible society and find a place in it. And that idea, that humanizing vision of consumption, I think is one that we should carry with us. It's one that also, I think, it speaks to the redistribution issue, but it also speaks to the issue of have we had enough of stuff? And one of the troubles with that model, and it was pointed out very early on by an economist called Lancaster, is that goods, material goods, are not goods. They are bundles of attributes. And some of those play functional needs. Food, for example, is very functional in nutrition, but as Lord Skidelsky pointed out, if you have too much for it, it's also dysfunctional. But there's a lot of attributes of goods that are actually about the social and psychological conditions of flourishing as a society, and iPads is only one of those. And so there is a sense in which the goods that we have are not just a functional set of commodities. They are signifiers, they are symbols, they talk in a language, as Mary Douglas herself pointed out, and they are the language with which we communicate with each other. And we've created a society partly through advertising, in which everyone has to do that. And in fact, you know, have we had enough of stuff? Well, if the gentleman who asked the question has had enough of stuff, we have a variety of means to persuade you that you haven't still, and advertising is only one of them. We can provide you with, you can have, you know, money that you don't have to spend on things you don't need, to create impressions that won't last on people you don't care about. This is pathological, but it is also system-driven. And one of the reasons for driving the system, and I come back to that question, one of the reasons for driving the system is this desire for growth. And so if you can only afford less time by increasing your productivity growth, you're never going to solve this question of designing a society in which it's possible to afford the care services that you want, even though they're not so productive. To not work so many hours as you would like to if you choose not to. To create the conditions in which you can have common goods, in which you can have shared goods, in which consumption is a collaborative activity. And all of those conditions go out of the window while you're still chasing these elusive goals of productivity. And to come back to my book, of course, what I should have done, and I realise now, I should have borrowed it from the library.
Thank you, Tim. Okay, now... Thank you very much. There is now, neatly avoiding the question, because time has run out about how much time people at NEF spend at work, I'm going to bring this to a close and thank you all very much and apologise for there not being enough time for you to ask all those questions and make all those comments. There is a drinks reception outside for those of you who are quick enough to get there. Thank you. Before you all leave, please thank our speakers.